And welcome back to Coast. Bill Douglas, our special guest. His book is called The Gospel of Science. Website, of course, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And we'll be back with your calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Bill Douglas with us. We'll get to your phone calls as well. Bill, your book, The Gospel of Science, where do people get it?
It's available on Amazon worldwide and other online booksellers as well. And it just came out, so it may be in bookstores at some point, but it's not right now.
Okay, cool. It's a great book. And your favorite website for people to get a hold of you?
It's smarttaichi.com / Gospel of Science. And that's smarttaichi, smarttaichi.com / Gospel of Science.
Well, I like how you kind of meshed the spiritual things with science, and you made it all work.
It all came together. I had a really amazing kind of ethereal experience when I was in my mid-20s. I had gone through a great tragedy. I lost my mother and my father and my youngest son within about a year, and I was just spiraling downward. And then I just decided, you know, not to go that route, and I threw myself started kind of getting involved in meditation and Tai Chi and Qigong and things. And so I just threw myself into the mind-body stuff. And then one night I had this extraordinary experience, and I actually start off the book talking about Giordano Bruno. He was a Jesuit priest back in the 1600s. And anyway, he went into a deep sleep one night, and he had this vision, and his vision was that he saw the universe for what it is, because back then they thought that the Earth was the center of the universe, and he saw that the sun, that the planets revolved around the sun, and that all the stars that you see in the sky were actually, many of them were like our sun that had planets rotating around him. And then it was just so clear to him that he went around trying to convince everybody that this was the case, and he ended up getting in big trouble.
Oh, they thought he was a heretic, didn't they?
Yeah, that's exactly right, yeah. But eventually science caught up with him, and so about 40 years ago, when I was in my 20s, and something real similar happened to me. I went to bed, and about 3 o'clock in the morning, I had this experience, and I just saw how simple and elegant so many of the problems that modern society is facing could be solved so elegantly. And it's such a, you know, and in such a seemingly simple way that would heal all the, you know, all the leaves of the tree by nurturing the root, which is human consciousness. And it was like I knew this was true, but I couldn't do anything with it. You know, it was like I had this experience. But then what I did was I started collecting all the science over this 40-year journey. And when I would see these scientific breakthroughs, I would recognize it as like a piece of this puzzle that I had already seen put together when I had this experience. And so over these years, it's like all the pieces have fallen into place so elegantly, so that as you read through this book, The Gospel of Science, you see that we could massively cut our health costs and also prison costs and police costs. And this could all be done at a very low cost by implementing these things into public schools worldwide. And it's already starting to happen, but I mean, given the science on it, it should be happening on a massive level in public education all over the world, because these techniques treat attention deficit disorder and hyperactivity disorder. And the schools that have started implementing these kind of programs have not only seen much better behavior in their students, less bullying and much better behavior, but the students also perform much better scholastically. So, it's really, in the book, I actually make the point that it's really insane that we haven't already made these things a core part of public education, you know, to teach students how to modulate their brainwaves so that their bodies are healthier and their minds are more creative. And the research shows that it actually increases your IQ.
Why does it seem, Bill, that if you keep working, you tend to live longer?
I think that when you stay engaged and stay curious, I think that it has a huge impact on your DNA expression you know, which affects everything that you do. And that's one of the things, you know, Einstein was a big meditator, and he said, you know, the moment that you're not, you know, filled with wonder about the you know, world and the universe, is the day that you're as good as dead. And he realized that, you know, that we that our consciousness it feeds on curiosity and wonderment, and that's one of the things that these kind of alpha wave producing techniques produce, is that sense of wonderment. It's like everything seems more fresh and new after you let your mind kind of clear of all the clutter and everything. And the way one of the, since I mentioned Einstein, the kind of the culmination of my book is that one of the reasons that I wrote this book is because people, a lot of people have a very grim view of the future for humanity. And when you read through this science that I've collected over 40 years, you realize that the opposite is true. About 50,000 years ago, anthropologists and historians call that period the Great Leap Forward. And it was a period where all over Africa and Europe and Western Asia, people all over those areas of the planet had a huge leap forward in their technology, the way that they grew plant crops, the way that they herded animals, the way that they, you know, created their structures that they live in. Everything took a huge leap forward, and they can't really explain why it happened simultaneously all over you know, most of the populated world at the time. And I think that where we're at right now in humanity, and the science that I've put together proves this, that we're at the cusp of something that is much more profound than the Great Leap Forward. These things have the potential of global transformation, you know, reducing conflict and war, all these things, by spreading these things throughout the planet. It would be extremely cost-effective, and it would save us trillions of dollars every year right off the bat from saved healthcare costs. Herb Benson, Dr. Herbert Benson, who I mentioned in the book, he's a Harvard researcher that has spent his life studying these mind-body techniques, and he has a great book called The Relaxation Response, which I highly recommend. And Herb Benson, the research that he's done shows him that between 60 and 90% of the health issues that are sending people to their doctors are best treated by mind-body practices. And that was reflected in a Kaiser Permanente. They did a long-term study, and they found that 70% of the health issues that were sending people to their doctors were caused by stress, not aggravated by stress, but caused by stress. So the organic funk dysfunction that people were suffering was rooted in chronic unmanaged stress. And when I called Kaiser, I talked to Dr. David Sobel, who was familiar with that study, and he said that figure could go as high as 85%. 85% of the major health issues sending people to the doctor,
that's huge,
are caused by stress. So we could be saving trillions of dollars, you know,
that
just
is huge.
Very quickly.
Let's take some calls here for you. Let's go to Joe, Long Island, New York. Welcome to the program, Joseph. Go ahead.
Hey, Bill. Great information. Question and like an observation.
Uh-huh.
My question would be, you mentioned, you know, trying to approach problems linearly, and this idea of being additive versus maybe being expansive, with there being an overlap between the two. But take, for example, Mike Tyson or Jay Leno, they add cars to cars. But to really be expansive, they would maybe need to drive a car in an exotic location. You know, like Steve McQueen took his motorbike down with his first wife, Nellie, to Mexico. That's kind of being expansive rather than additive. And then you mentioned Princess Diana, and at that time, I remember when she died, was going to college that had a European connection, and people opened the door for you. You know, I'm being a New Yorker, I'm like, where are these people from? Who are these people that they would hold the door, open a door for you? And when she died, I looked at the reaction of people and the funeral and how sad they were. And there was a picture in the paper of a girl just by herself, a very attractive girl, weeping in a church. And to me, that was unfamiliar. You know, that public display of grief that was really worldwide seemed like it was like kind of good to see that people did grieve, but it was also unfamiliar, being more familiar at the time with the perspective of, you know, the New Yorker with the thick veneer. And also, I had been taking a course at that time, and one of the things in the notes, the person said, your work experience could be deadening. And that's also one spectrum, too, where something could be deadening or enlivening. And he also said, always bring a notebook with you. You could get that insight while eating a pizza.
Where's the question, Joseph?
So I just want to ask about just that spectrum between dead, feeling deadened and enlivened.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the thing, you know, of course we can engage in trips and things like that, and I think those things are all very beneficial. But the thing that makes, you know, these alpha wave producing techniques quite unique is that you can do them anytime, anywhere. And when the mind goes into that alpha state, to me, it's kind of akin to a reboot. You know, it's like if you use as many programs on your computer as I do, your computer starts to get kind of kludgy because you've had so many programs open. It's got like things interfering with other things. And so then you get to a point where you have to reboot your computer. You have to turn your computer off, and you can hear those, you know, those circuits shutting down. You can hear the, you know, the, everything going down. And then when you turn it back on, then it's fresh and clear, and it sees everything in a clear, refreshed way. And that's what happens when we go into these mind-body practices on a regular basis, because we're letting the mind just clear itself of all the static and all the debris. And then when we come back to the world, it's fresh and new. And then that also enables us to, like I said before, the research shows that people that meditate regularly are much more effective at actualizing the kind of lives that they want. And I think if we can expand these things through public education worldwide, that could have a profound impact on the future of the planet, because you would have a generation of students coming out of university, you know, about 18 years from now, who would essentially be mind-body masters. And they would not only be, you know, they would have higher IQs, the research shows, they'd be more creative, the research shows, they'd be vastly healthier, so that'd save us a lot of health costs, but they'd also be much better at actualizing the life that they would want. And that could take on huge proportions throughout society, because one of the things that I get into in the book is that, you know, one of the things that we're facing is the robotization of a lot of jobs. You know, the robots are going to, you know, take a lot of jobs in the future, and there's different ways of looking at that. You know, one way we could look at it is, well, that's a horrible thing because it's going to take away jobs, but it's going to produce, you know, it's going to take over a lot of the production things, and it's going to give people, if we plan it out right, it can enable people to create a whole new economy. And like I was saying earlier, our DNA heals when we're involved in altruistic activities that help other people. So what a lot of people do is they'll volunteer for something when, you know, when they're off. You know, they'll work their job, and then they'll, when they're off, they'll do something, you know, altruistic. So it's kind of a hobby. But we have the potential with the robotization of so many of the, you know, basic production jobs and things like that. We have the ability to kind of redefine our whole future economy. Where we can create an economy where people are, their jobs are actually helping other people. Like maybe we might have people that are going around the neighborhood making sure that old people who, you know, if they need something off their shelf or if they need a gutter cleaned or something, you know, that would be their job. You know, and for a lot of people, that would be like a dream job. You know, could you imagine, you know, just doing things that are going to make people really happy?
Do you find that the evil people or mean people can't get this done? That these things don't happen for them?
Which you mean? Actualizing the life that you want, or
like in a meditative state, good things happen to people.
Uh-huh.
Could you say that a person who is mean or evil, it's not going to happen to them?
Well,
or can they meditate too?
Yes, everybody can meditate. Everybody can meditate, and You know, and one of the things that that's come for me personally out of meditation, and I don't think it's personal to me because, you know, I've read so many things that validate it for other people as well. But you know, as I practice these techniques, I don't see people as good or evil as in the same way that I used to. What I kind of see, the way that I see it now, is I kind of see people that are more on track and people that are more lost.
Or off the track.
Yeah, exactly, off the track. Because our natural tendency, like I was saying, you know, our DNA knows that when we're contributing to the collective good, our DNA is in a healing state. When we're only looking out for number one, it's in a degraded health state, and so we have that natural tendency to you know, be good, and also to you know, to treat other people well, like your caller was just talking about, you know, the response that people had in New York City when they were in that emotional state from Princess Diana. So we have that natural tendency, and what the science is showing us is that when the prophets of old were telling us to treat other people kindly, and in fact, they're telling us that when you treat the way that you treat other people is how you treat me. Or in the case of like Buddha, for example, he said that when you treat other people badly, that proves that you don't like yourself. And the science is showing us that that's actually true. That it's not, it wasn't some airy platitude that these you know, ancient prophets were telling us. They were trying to give us a prescription for how to function in the world in the most helpful way that would make us feel the best about ourselves and also would contribute to the greater whole, because everything's connected. You know, we see that with quantum entanglement and all these things as well. And so it's really kind of amazing, you know, when you look at this new science and then you look back at, you know, because there were basically two fundamental cores of all the major religions, prophets, what they were talking about. One was the state of our consciousness, and the other one was compassion for other people. And all this new science is showing us that those weren't airy platitudes. They were trying to give us a really functional prescription for a future that we could, you know, really enjoy living in. And so the thing that I get into in the end of the book is this concept of a self-fulfilling prophecy. The world that we ruminate on is the world that we're creating in our consciousness right now. And Albert Einstein said that the most important question that you can ask yourself, the most important question that we can ask ourselves is the universe a friendly place? Because every decision that we make, everything that unfolds in our life is going to come from the answer to that question.
What is that answer?
The answer is yes. Because when you look at the science, what you find, one thing that I get into in the book is Charles Darwin. Here in Kansas City, we have one of the best World War I museums in the world. And when you walk...
You're in Kansas City, Kansas, right?
I'm in Kansas, yeah, but the World War I museum's in Missouri. But we're
we won't get the Super Bowl team wrong. Like,
yeah, yeah, it's all one city, and Kansas claims the Chiefs. Yeah, we're totally in on that. But anyway, when you go in this World War I museum, they have one Darwin's book, and they say that this played a big role in the advent of World War I, because there was a lot, and it's not a comment on Darwin, because I'll get into that in a second, but it's the way that people interpreted Darwin's writing, because they took that survival of the fittest, and what they did was they used it to kind of suggest that their culture was superior to other cultures, and the museum points out that had a big impact on kind of the formation of World War I. Now,
hold on for a second, Bill. We'll be back in a moment and wrap things up with final calls. On our next Coast to Coast program, we'll talk about the art of war, and then later on, Suzanne Wilson joins us to talk about soul communications. That ought to be fascinating. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Bill Douglas. His work is called The Gospel of Science, as promised. Let's go to your calls before the clock gets us. Ed in Charlotte, North Carolina. Eddie, go ahead.
Yeah, George, you mentioned the word mind control a while ago.
Oh, yeah.
And that's going to be my question in a minute. With BD from Doonesbury, I guess you got there, Bill Douglas. You talked about the little electrons spinning and complementing, and we see that when all the 100 birds on the telephone line jump at the same instant. You know, a little dry humor there. I had polio as a child, and I had an autoimmune illness, kind of like multiple sclerosis, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis later, early in life, that was took me from 180 to 105 pounds. I was in bed 4 years in a lot of pain.
Oh, boy.
Doctors couldn't do anything, and I was very fortunate. I found a great Tai Chi teacher in Qigong. I started getting really into this, and everything you say resonates with everything I've learned, and I was really into it. So I'm familiar with about everything you mentioned.
Uh-huh.
And like in Tai Chi, I had one of the symptoms is Raynaud's, where your fingers get white, and they numb because there's no blood flow, and people think it's blood flow. It's really the nerve cutting the blood flow off. And when you do Tai Chi, within 8 minutes or something, you're just warm. You can feel the fuzz or the little tickling of the electrical field around you.
Yeah, like isn't that amazing?
The opening exercise I do, you open 7 acupuncture meridians right away. So there are a lot of things I could tell you, but I want to ask a question. Back then, 50, 60 years ago, there was a guy called Jose Silva wrote a book, Mind Control.
That's right.
And he had a huge following, and he was a teenager in Texas.
They had class. They had little schools and shops all over the place, Silva Mind Control shops.
Oh, let me tell you, he was a teenager, and he was in the barbershop reading Popular Mechanics, and he got interested in things like the ionosphere going up and down at night, and he actually got some early patents, and he was doing a lot of this at first. Now, I want to ask you this. He told us, and when he went to South America, he'd fill stadiums up like Billy Graham here in the United States, and by the way, he uses the word gospel by his church upbringing, where he says the teacher taught him it meant literally good news, so that he's kind of breaking that science religion thing, which is a great approach, I think. So he would have us, you look up at a 45-degree angle, and when you close your eyes, he claimed you went right into that state. By doing that, and I know people, if we had 200 people in an auditorium, five people, raise your hands, five people have a headache, somebody would go and put their hands an inch or so over their head and do that, look up and close their eyes, and then tense their hands back and forth real tight and kind of make a feel, electrical feel, and the headache would be gone in a minute. So
wow,
I was wanting to know if... if this is, you are familiar with Jose Silver's approach and all.
Go ahead, Bill.
It sounds familiar somewhere in my mind, you know, as you're talking about it, but it's not anything that I've, investigated deeply. But, over these 40 years that I've been practicing these things and teaching them, and had the opportunity to travel the planet, you know, and study with teachers all over the world. I've realized that there are so many approaches to these things, and what I realized, you know, as I was, you know, putting the book together and, you know, over the years formulating this, you know, this kind of vision that the book promotes, is that what they all have in common, there's, you know, so many different approaches to mind-body practices, but what they all have in common is taking the brain into those alpha brainwave states. And so all the different approaches, you know, whether it's Tai Chi or yoga or, you know, different kinds of meditation or whatever, that commonality that they all share is the brain waves going into the alpha state. And that seems like that's where the magic occurs. You know, that's where the body starts to heal. You know, the DNA starts to heal. The DNA expression starts to change. And then that's also when we get those behavioral improvements, you know, the brain changes, you know, that make us easier to get along with and more able to work, collaboratively with teams. So it's that alpha state that these things all share. And it sounds like, you know, that he was one of the early pioneers that was showing, you know, masses of people how to achieve.
Oh, he wasn't. Bill, what happened? They had Silva mind control clinics everywhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember that in the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. They were all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Next up, let's go to Fausto in Toronto. Welcome to the program. Hi, Fausto.
Hi, George Norrie and guest Bill. I believe your name is Bill.
Yes, very good.
Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Excuse me if I'm not going to be able to articulate this as well as one of George Norrie's previous guests had done many moons ago. Based upon my observation over the past 20-odd years, a lot of people who do meditation are very narcissistic. They're only about themselves. They're extremely self-centered. And that's why I think, as one of the previous callers has stated a few seconds ago, that there was a big Billy Graham drawing, if you will, a big crowd that would fill up stadiums, he said, or he claimed. And I believe it's a big draw if people are told you can do whatever you want to do as long as it feels good, live for the moment. Don't think. Thinking is an offense. Just feel, live for the moment. Empty your mind without considering other people's feelings. And when they have this, what am I trying to say here, low level of tolerance, as their circle of tolerance shrinks smaller and smaller because it's always about themselves. If people are only about themselves, they're going to be at each other's throats. And it's a very reckless way of so-called thinking. For instance, let's just use it as hypothetical. Let's say a girl doesn't want to tell her parents where she's going because she doesn't want her parents to tell her, don't go away to Scotland. We don't know, don't do these dangerous things. Well, my mom and dad bug me. I don't like how I feel. It bugs me to feel. So I'm just not going to think. I'll empty my mind and live for the moment. Next thing you know, she ends up in a very dangerous situation, getting sick or possibly even kidnapped. Her parents don't know what continent she is in Europe. Next thing you know, she could be deceased. They were breaking someone's heart, a very nice, sweet guy, because she just wants to live for the moment. Tells you she loves you today. The next day you get a phone call, ring, hello. I can't be with you anymore. But you told me you loved me. Well, I meant it yesterday. That's very typical of many yogaites, as I call them. Very thoughtless, very heartless. And they're on a rampage. And of course they feel good because there's no accountability.
Speak about accountability, Bill.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, I've been a tax-paying worker and employee and business owner my whole life, paid taxes and raised two kids and have several grandkids. And so what I go by in the book is I go by the science. And the science shows that that people, their behavior towards other people becomes more empathetic and compassionate, not disconnected. And I before I became aware of the science on it, you know, I had, I guess I was drawn to the science because I had these anecdotal experiences with my own life, you know, where I treated people better. I felt more connected to people when I started meditating. And when I first started teaching at the hospital that I talked about at the beginning, there was an emergency room physician named John. And I ended up having to give him private lessons at his home because he had a weird schedule, because he worked in ER. And I remember after a couple weeks, he told me one night when I came over, he goes, Bill, he goes, I got to be honest with you. He goes, I don't get this meditation stuff. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. I don't really understand the concept of it. And I just, you know, it just doesn't make sense to me. And I told him, well, just keep playing at it, John. You know, don't be too hard, you know, don't be hard on yourself. If your mind wanders or whatever, just come back to the exercise and the experience. And then the next week when I came over, he goes, I think I'm starting to get this meditation stuff. And I said, oh, really? I said, how so, John? And he said, well, he said, this week, he said, my ER staff told me, they said, man, we don't know what you've been doing, but you were way easier to get along with than you were before.
So even your personality changes then.
Yes, because your brain changes. Your fear and stress part of your brain shrinks, and your empathy and compassion part of your brain enlarges. And so then what happens is you just start interacting with people on a different level, even as you don't realize it. Because, you know, like I said, that ER physician, John, you know, he didn't think it was working. You know, he didn't get it, you know, but it was having an impact, and it was having an impact on the way that he was engaging with the people around him. And from my experience, I mean, I can only go from my experience and from the science. And from my experience in the science, you know, over 40 years teaching thousands of people how to do it, and I know teachers all over the world that have very similar experiences, people become, you know, really less self-centered when they practice these things, because you touch into that reality of our being, and the reality of our being is that we are connected. We're connected to the people around us, and as I've practiced these techniques over the years, I've just noticed, you know, that I'm just much more in tune with how other people around me are feeling, and I'm much more sensitive to, you know, how my actions affect them, as opposed to the way that I perceived it before.
Do you like who you are?
Like my mind was just too busy, you know, with things. And then when I started clarifying, you know, clearing my mind on a regular basis, then it's like I would notice the looks on people's faces, you know, if I said a certain thing or whatever. You know, it made me more attuned to them.
I mean, does it make you a person where you like who you are now?
Yes, much more. You know, I mean, I go through tribulations just like everybody does. You know what I mean? We all have moments.
You're a human. Oh, no, you're a human.
Of course, of course. But having said that, it's like meditation made me much more compassionate with myself, because when you first start meditating, even if you've been meditating for a long time, you know, things come into your mind and, you know, your mind wanders and gets distracted and stuff. And so when I first started meditating, I would like scold myself for that. I would think, oh, I'm a bad meditator. I'm meditating badly. And then over time, I got to a point where I realized I had to stop doing that. I had to stop berating myself, or else I would just have to quit meditating because it was
too crazy. Let's go to Josh in South Florida. Josh, go ahead.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Okay.
I wanted to make a comment, and I had a question. So the comment is, I feel like the base form of meditation is being able to have those tough conversations with yourself. You know, I'm an only child, so I've had many days alone where all I could talk to was myself, and I've asked people that as an adult, hey, when was the last day you never said a word except to yourself? And everyone I ask, they can't answer that question. So I think at the base form, it's knowing yourself and having those tough conversations with yourself, which can progress you in life. And now my question, and I'll take everything off air,
okay,
is kind of about the quantum theory. It's something I've been thinking about. Now, according to my research with quantum theory, if I'm going to try to explain this in the best way I can, now at any given time, I'm given a choice, A, B, C, or D. And the fact that each of those choices exist, it means that it doesn't matter what I choose, like at that given time, because I had the option to choose, it means every single timeline and how I got there has existed, will exist, and whether in my reality or not, I choose, you know, door B, it doesn't negate the fact that A, C, and D with infinite possibilities have happened because of the fact that I was given those options at the time. And I'll take my question off air.
Well, I actually get into this in the book. That's a real interesting thing that you pointed out there, because one of the concepts of quantum physics is that all possible realities exist all the time. But what brings the reality into existence, the one that we're actually living, is where our consciousness goes. And this ties back to something that I was getting into before the break. I was talking about the World War One Museum, and they have Darwin's book, Survival of the Fittest. And that concept of survival of the fittest kind of played a role in World War One happening. But the Einstein question is the universe a friendly place? Darwin's sequel to that, to the Origin of Species book, it only mentioned survival of the fittest twice, and it mentioned love and cooperation several hundred times. And what Darwin, the picture that Darwin paints is the reason that humanity has ascended to its, you know, premier place on the planet isn't because we're stronger or more violent than other creatures. But Darwin says that it's because of our love, our ability to connect with others even beyond our family or our tribe, and that's what rose humanity to the premier spot that it's in on the planet right now, was our love and cooperation. And when we look at the DNA research that I mentioned, you know, about how when we're doing things that are helpful to the collective whole, that our DNA heals. So it seems like this is kind of written into the fabric of the universe, this tremendous possibility. And so I wanted to write this book to create another kind of possible future, because so much of the popular media is filled with a pretty dismal view of the possibilities for humanity. And when you look at the science that I've put together in this book, you see that, like I mentioned before, the answer to Einstein's all-important question, is the universe a friendly place? The answer to that is yes. And so our consciousness will, in terms of the quantum theory, our consciousness will bring to the fore the possible reality that we imagine in our consciousness.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Bill, for being on the program. The name of the book, The Gospel of Science. Incredible questions tonight. You folks are deep, deep thinkers. For Dan Galante, Gina Salvati, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, Tim Vidal, Ian Punnett, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.